Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the 18th lecture in our Vancouver Institute 1960-61 series. We are very grateful for this large attendance this evening, for an old friend still with us, I think, in spirit, even though he lives in Washington, D.C. Ordinarily, you know, when we have speakers here at the Institute, we try to compose some biography or curriculum vitae, these speakers, by composing them either through the regular texts, who's who or what not. But in this instance, we thought that we would write and obtain a correct curriculum vitae. And we did. We wrote to someone who knows Mr. Minifee better than anyone else. And this is the reply we received. James MacDonald Minifee was born in England in 1900. He emigrated to Canada, where his father homesteaded. He grew up on the prairie and found the same difficulty as Senator Lyndon Johnson. He had to get up much too early. Senator Johnson claims that he owes his position as vice president-elect to the fact that he had to get up so early on the farm. Mr. Minifee takes the same view. He got up just as early without, however, attaining quite as high a position. He joined the Canadian Army in 1916 as a bugler, but forgot to bugle. He served as a private in an inconspicuous position before being discharged in March 1919 as acting sergeant, seconded to the Royal Air Force. Having served in World War I underage, he served in World War II overage as a civilian operator in the Office of Strategic Services, an American cloak and dagger outfit. This took him from Algiers through Sicily and Italy to Austria in what was known as the psychological warfare branch. At the end of the war, the British settled for an OBE and the American for the Medal of Freedom. In between wars, Mr. Minifee had gone to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. He took a temporary position with the Herald Tribune in 1929 and left in 1953 to join the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which has posted him as Washington correspondent. Now, this was sent to us, and I believe in sworn testimony is true. We thought that after reading the same, our distinguished expatriate, it reminded some of my colleagues of the description in Luke of the return of the prodigal son. And the son said, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight. And the father said, bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry, for this is my son was lost, and he is found. To James Temple.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, after that introduction, I'm sure that you will all agree with me that it would be much better if Dr. Nimitz gave the address than I. I was fascinated by this account of myself. I think it's the best biography of myself that I've heard since the one written by Professor Charles Lightbody of the University of Saskatchewan and duly printed as an obituary notice on the occasion of my capture in the Spanish Civil War. The report of my demise, like Mark Twain's, was exaggerated, I think. I'm always fascinated by that other introduction of the minister who introduced the speaker with a prayer, saying, O Lord, thou who alone canst work miracles, inspire this speaker tonight. That's a real steal, and then I'm not going to acknowledge the man from whom I stole it. I picked it up last night, and thank you. I had the great pleasure last month of meeting your very able and genial Secretary for External Affairs in the White House. I met him while the President of the United States had just gone back indoors to get the Prime Minister's coat. Mr. Green very kindly said that he'd been here the week before and had torn me to bits. And he was very glad to hear that I was going to come along a couple of weeks following and advise me to put myself together again. And this is, in a manner of speaking, an effort so to do. I wouldn't want to compete, however, in the field in which the Right Honorable Howard Green, that very able and distinguished statesman, so eminently adorns. These propositions that I'm putting forward tonight are in no way political. This is, if I may give it a rather presumptuous title, a philosophical study of the political implications of the enormous change which has come over the world with the development of the atomic weapon, the change in the political consequences, the change in the economic and physical consequences, the whole change in the manner of thinking with which we must approach modern-day problems. There are legitimate fields of exploration of Canadian political philosophy in the framework not of politics, but of human survival, in which we're all very much concerned. It doesn't matter whether it's conservatives or liberals, Canadians or Americans, CCF or social creditors, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Eisenhower, Mr. Diefenbaker, or Mr. Nixon, Mr. Pearson, or Mr. Argue. This is not a matter of politics. It is a matter of human survival. Now, I want to call your attention tonight, right away, to a series of statements put forward by President Kennedy in his inaugural address, not as hyperbole, but a statement of fact, not a figure of speech at all, but the solid statement that the end of the world is well within the compass of man's powers. That is no longer a figure of speech, but it's a real thing. Mr. Kennedy made three references in his inaugural address to this possibility that the end of the world is within man's power to compass. Man holds in his mortal hands, he said, the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. And he urged both sides in their quest for peace to intensify it before the dark powers of destruction unleashed by science engulf all humanity in planned or accidental self-destruction. And a few sentences later, he noted that both sides were racing to alter that uncertain balance of terror which stays the hand of mankind's final war. I submit that this fact, that the end of the world is within the power of man to achieve, is justification for an entirely new approach, an entirely new manner of thinking. The new president was asked at his first press conference why he had devoted himself in his inaugural address almost exclusively to global problems rather than to domestic policies, and he replied, "Well, the issue of war and peace is involved, and the survival of the planet, possibly our system. Therefore, this is a matter of primary concern to the people of the world, and I think it may be a matter of primary concern to us tonight as world citizens." I'll just take one more example of the real concern from people very high up. Paul Henri Spaak, who until last month was Secretary General of NATO, told the NATO Parliamentarians Conference in November a year ago, in November 1959, he said this: "There is something, I think, that public opinion has not yet realized sufficiently. It seems to me, said Spark, that the introduction, the discovery of atomic weapons, has brought about a sensational and fundamental revolution in what we call, by a strange combination of words, the art of war. And he went on and said, I've been told again and again, men will always fight because men have always fought in the past. And Mr. Spark said, this explanation of human history is too simple. It must be asked why men have always fought. And the answer is simple. Because when men have fought in the past, there was always one side, and sometimes both sides, which expected to be the victors. That is, they sincerely thought that after a severe ordeal, the problems they had to solve in peace would be more easily solved after the war. The Chinese are about the only people nowadays who are still committed to that theory, and they are very strongly in antagonism to their fellows in the communist faith in that belief that things would be improved by a good hearty war and that you could start in from the very beginning again and be much better off. Spark, again, I am quoting from his talk to the NATO parliamentarian, said, nobody can believe that now. The idea of a military victory, as it has existed and in its role in the history of humanity, must be struck from our vocabulary. I ask you to consider those words very carefully. I'll say again the words of Spark. The idea of a military victory, as it has existed, and in its role in the history of humanity, must be struck from our vocabulary. A military victory is no longer possible, says Spark. There is not a man, capitalist or communist, who thinks, who can believe, that if there were a new world war, that after this war, the problems which he would have to solve would be easier than the problems which he now has. Mr. Spark did, as a matter of fact, not allow for the Chinese conviction that war would enable social reform to be carried out at an enhanced rate. A very great English observer of the scene, the Foreign Secretary, the Earl of Hume, had this to say about it in the House of Lords. We all know that whereas it was once possible to live apart, it's no longer possible to do so, and unless in fact we succeed in living together, none of us will live at all. President Kennedy, Paul Henri Spark, the Earl of Hume, all uttering those same thoughts. And this is my text today, tonight. And as I once had ambitions to be a classical scholar and didn't get up quite early enough in the morning to achieve that, I'll use the words that were given to me on my way here. When I left Washington, when I left home 4 days ago, climbed into a taxi, driven by a Negro chauffeur, we indulged in the usual dilettante conversation about this and that for a little while, and finally, talking about the immutability of human affairs, the Negro taxi chauffeur said to me, tempora mutanta, nocet mutama in illis. And I said to him, where'd you go to school? And he said, well, obviously not Harvard. He went to school, in fact, in the British West Indies. He was a Jamaican. We had a long and very interesting conversation on that theme. Tempora mutanta, the times change, and we change with them. He was an optimist. I hope we do change with them, because we must change with them if we are to survive. For there has been a very tremendous change, advance in scientific thinking, which has not been accompanied by a comparable advance in political thinking. And a substantially new manner of political thinking is now essential if we are to survive, if the end of the world is not to be accomplished. And it's towards this new manner of thinking that I hope to direct your thoughts and mine this evening, again reminding you that indulging in political thinking is not the same as indulging in politics, without, of course, intending any slur on the latter. To a degree which few of us will admit, our attitudes are dominated by habits of thought which even the communists, or the most advanced communists, are already beginning to consider obsolete. Lenin's slogan that war is inevitable, and that it must as inevitable forward the ideological concepts of the victor, is out of date. Premier Khrushchev is leaving that rudimentary concept to the Chinese, along with the thought that Trotsky was a British agent and that Stalin was always right. The Chinese themselves will no doubt grow out of this in time, but I would be sorry indeed to think that only the Western world still cherishes the obsolete Clausewitz formula that war is or could be a real political instrument, a continuation of political commerce by other means. This is no longer true under current conditions. The factor which changed the earlier concept was, of course, the atomic bomb, which is roughly 1,000 times as potent as ordinary explosive, and on top of it, the hydrogen bomb, which is roughly 1,000 times as potent as the atomic bomb, or 1,000,000 times as potent as ordinary explosive. Let's go back a little bit to refresh your knowledge of these awful instruments. The effect of atomic weapons, nuclear weapons, is threefold. One, heat and blast. Two, contamination of the surrounding and downwind territory by radioactive fallout. And three, contamination of the atmosphere. If you'll forgive me, I'll go back over some of the effects of those for a very brief instant to remind you and myself of what we're up against. The heat of the extent, the effect of heat and blast has been extensively studied, and I don't need to go into this in detail. Those who wish to follow this particular interest should consult a study produced by the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions under the aegis of the Fund for the Republic, which took as an example, among many other things, the Los Angeles area, and showed that it could be entirely obliterated by one single 10-megaton bomb. Its 2.5 million inhabitants would all be destroyed by a single 10-megaton bomb, which is by no means the ultimate in bomb production. There are much more potent ones. You're well enough acquainted, I'm sure, with the problems created by contamination from immediate fallout. Survivors of blast and heat in the immediate neighborhood would need the material and spiritual resources to remain in shelters for at least 3 weeks before making a break for a safer environment. There has been little skepticism about this. People have denied that it would be necessary to remain in shelters for so long a period of time after an explosion somewhere in more than 10 or 15 miles away of a major weapon. But there's a recent event which very strikingly confirms the skepticism of the scientists about the ability about the need. The skepticism of the scientists about the ability to move out of a refuge before at least three weeks were expired. On January the 3rd, 1961, that is last January the 3rd, there occurred what was termed a nuclear excursion, but you and I would call a runaway chain reaction, in the boiling water reactor at the Argonne National Laboratory in Idaho. The controls failed to act, the nuclear reaction got out of hand, and a very small nuclear explosion took place on January the 3rd, 1961, in Idaho. It was a microscopically small nuclear explosion in the terms in which we think of nuclear explosions. But the three men who were on duty in the reactor room lost their lives. It took place 10 weeks ago, and what happened still cannot be ascertained precisely because the reactor room is far too radioactive 10 weeks afterwards, today at this very moment, to permit close inspection. Because of the high radiation levels, it wasn't possible even to enter the room in an emergency suit fully protected in order to remove the body of the second crewman who'd been killed by the explosion for 2 days. It was a week before, with the greatest protection possible, an emergency crew could dash in and remove the body of the third crewman. 1 week before, with every precaution, they could move into that room where a very minor, microscopically small nuclear explosion had taken place. So much for the immediate effects of contamination from this very minor nuclear excursion. The effects of atmospheric contamination from large bursts are still disputed, but certainly nobody claims that they're beneficial. They could be fatal, and in an all-out war which recognized the possibility of 80 or 90 million casualties, immediate casualties on each side, the effects of ultimate fallout might be, as the president suggested, mankind's final war. Now, situation's been pretty well established, hasn't it? I've given you some fairly authentic authorities. We're not doing this on our own authority, yours and mine. What we're saying about a terminal war, a terminal cataclysm, is based on pretty solid authority. How do we avoid this terminal cataclysm? That's the question to which we have to put our minds. And there is only one way of avoiding it. It's the very simple way, or at least it's simple in statement, the way of maintaining the peace. Our problem is not how to win an all-out war. There will be no victors. That's not our problem. Our problem is quite different. It is the problem of how to maintain the peace. And I've suggested before this that Canada might make the most substantial contribution in its power toward maintaining the peace, toward avoiding this final war, by establishing itself as a neutral power, and from this vantage point, making its influence felt in the increasing world of the neutrals, that world which rejects categorically the imperative of siding with one or the other party in this race towards suicide. Many people don't agree with me. I maintain just as strongly my point of view. Many people do agree with me. The letters I've had from all over the country are extraordinarily comforting and extraordinarily indicative of very wide agreement with this theory that Canada, as a neutral, could make a greater impact on preserving peace than it could in any other way. Up to the present, the ranks of neutrals, this increasingly important group, are being packed with Afro-Asian states, and there is no present representative of Western Hemisphere thought. I regard this gap as very deplorable. I would like to see a representative of Western Hemisphere thought in this very important body of neutrals, this body which does not regard implication in the suicide race as a proper method or a good and reliable method of maintaining the peace. Some of those who've read my book, in which I I put forward these proposals have attacked my concept, and some of them, those who haven't read it, have attacked it too. In particular, one very able and eminent American, whose name I don't need to mention, who delivered a resounding attack on it in Toronto, but with that slight one, little bit off the target, which did suggest that he was not too well acquainted with the content of the book, and some inquisitive and intolerably impertinent reporter asked him if he had read it, and he had the usual answer to make, well, not all the way through, you understand, but I did look into it on the way up. For those who haven't read it, I would like briefly to summarize the argument. And first of all, I'd like to deal with the semantic difficulty of the word neutrality. I looked around for a longish time for a better word, but I couldn't find one, because there is a common association of the word neutrality with the idea of withdrawal. And by neutrality, I did not mean withdrawal. Quite the contrary, I understood and meant neutrality to mean a positive factor, an attribute which enables the nation in question to take a much larger and more effective role in world affairs than it could as a satellite of one of the great military protagonists. The idea that neutrality was inevitably passive apparently arose from the example of Switzerland, which has pushed it to the extreme of not even becoming a member of the United Nations. But in fact, Switzerland is the only example of passive neutrality. All the other neutrals, Sweden, India, Austria, ERA, Burma, Ghana, Yugoslavia, Cambodia, to mention only a few, are intensely active in international affairs and in no way inhibited by the tendency to regard them as in the Soviet camp. Let me make it clear then that neutrality is designed to permit greater international activity with greater flexibility than can be exercised under the restraints of military alliances. The most common objection revealed by my mail is that neutrality could not possibly be enforced in wartime, could not possibly be maintained in wartime. Some of my correspondents write, not all of them by any means, but not even a majority, but enough to warn me that this is a widely shared doubt. And they raise this question. In the event of all-out war, they say, Canada would certainly be attacked and would be as unable to maintain and preserve her neutrality as Belgium was in World War I. And my answer to that objection is, yes, this is quite correct. In the event of all-out war, Canadian neutrality would probably not be respected, and in this case, Canada could do nothing about it and would be destroyed. A neutral Canada, in the event of all-out war, could not preserve its neutrality. But this is also true of Canada as an ally. It would just as certainly be destroyed as Canada as a neutral, and so indeed would be the victim of the aggression, and so probably would the aggressor itself. In the considered view of President Kennedy, at all events, a view based on the best intelligence the United States can summon, so would the rest of the world, as I've pointed out in those citations from Mr. Kennedy's inaugural address. So would this planet, so would this race of man. Canada the neutral, Canada the satellite, or Canada the equal or unequal ally, would alike be destroyed. My point is not that Canadian neutrality would be consumed in the general Holocaust in the event of an all-out war, but that Canadian neutrality could be maintained and preserved in peacetime and would be a factor in the preservation of peace. In other words, all-out war would be less likely with Canada as a neutral than with Canada in its present role as a satellite of one of the protagonists. And if this assumption is correct, then all other arguments fall by the board. But another question comes up, is it in the nature of Canada to do this, or is it in her nature and her destiny to follow, simply to follow, the American lead? And we must start, I think, by asking ourselves whether Canada is a political personality in her own right, sufficiently distinctive to make a neutral policy valid and useful. In short, is Canada an individual nation, or a smaller, weaker facsimile of the United States, U.S. to the scale of 1/10? I think we have to make up our minds, and you must make up your minds about that before you go much further. Is Canada an individual nation with a character, past, a present, and a future of its own, or is it indeed now and in the future a miniature of the United States, a United States in replica on a 1/10 scale? I think that the answer doesn't depend on emotion or nationalism or jingoism. I think the answer is determined by the facts. The facts are fairly obvious, and I would like to draw them to your attention. Canada is not, whether you like it or not, for good or ill, Canada is not the United States in miniature. And this is a fact which is very hard for the best-intentioned Americans to recognize. Canada is a foreign power, and this is not only hard for Americans to realize, but is also very often overlooked by Canadians too. I remember that Senator Aiken was disturbed and astonished when I mentioned this in a quite offhand way. He said, but Canada is not a foreign power. Canada thinks basically exactly the way we do. You and I know that that's not true. And look at some of these many points of difference. The United States, Canada is not self-sufficient and has no means of becoming so. This is a fact which dictates policy. The United States policy toward foreign trade and the Canadian policy toward foreign trade are based on this fundamental difference. Foreign trade is approximately 15% of Canadian trade. It's only 4% of American trade. Consequently, Canadian policy must be much more conscious of the need to get along with other people. It cannot afford, for instance, the luxury of pretending that mainland China doesn't exist, for mainland China has just bought $60 million worth of Canadian grain, much of it wheat, hard wheat, high protein, good old Saskatchewan wheat, I was about to say, but I would probably be reminded that they grow some of it in Alberta too. They grow much more oil and gas in Alberta, so I think we'll still give Saskatchewan this fine tribute of its hard, high-protein Canadian wheat. Canada is, and probably will be, a raw material producer, exporter, although it will be a point of national interest to put as much manual work into the raw material as possible. But it will always be an exporter of iron ore, copper, zinc, nickel, natural gas, oil, as long as its supplies last, whereas the United States is primarily an exporter of the finished product. Their two interests are entirely different, and their two policies must be entirely different. The interest of the United States is to acquire raw materials as cheaply as possible on the world market. The interest of Canada is to sell them as dearly as possible on the world market. Entirely different facts make an entirely different policy inevitable. Another instance, the United States, after all, is a republic with a system of government quite different from the Canadian system, and so sensitive to the opinion of the voter at the grassroots level that it's virtually a plebiscitary government. Canada is a monarchy with a government exercising powers much more completely delegated by the people to their representatives. A member of parliament, for example, can act much more independently of day-to-day public emotion than a congressman can. Take another example. Canada is a bilingual country with flourishing cultures deriving from two different sources and capable of mutual cross-fertilization and benefit, whereas the United States is monolithic. Its ideal is the melting pot. There couldn't be a more complete difference in approach and in goal. But above all, Canada is being technologically neutralized by the great advance in research and development in scientific fields in the United States. Canada voluntarily declined to go into atomic weapons production, although her scientists then had the know-how. The defense contribution ended with the interceptor. So in all these respects, political, economic, and military, it's apparent that Canada is not a replica in miniature of the United States, but a foreign power with quite different personality and problems. This being the case, the solutions to the Canadian problem of how it can best use its potentialities in the service of world peace must also be quite different to the solution adopted by the United States to the problem of how it can best use its potentialities in the service of peace. They're both in the service of peace, but they have different things to work with, and their policies must necessarily be different. They cannot be the same. The policy of Canada cannot be the same as that of the United States on a smaller scale, because Canada, as I've pointed out, is not the United States on a smaller scale, either with respect to its problems or its potentialities. And any attempt to use Canada as a small auxiliary of the United States in its approach to problems of defense and foreign policy is to abandon the strong points of Canadian position in favor of a small and increasingly smaller role as a military satellite or auxiliary of the United States, a role which steadily erodes Canadian independence and reduces its ability to make its maximum contributions to the world. You'll find very much the same concept in Mexico and Brazil, and particularly the modern Brazil, the Brazil of the new president, Jânio Quadros. The problem in these countries, and notably in Brazil, in the countries of Latin America, is complicated by a profound need for economic help, coupled with their determination not to accept strings on that help. Another objection, which is sometimes advanced to the problem of Canadian neutrality, is that it could not be maintained and preserved in peacetime against the wishes of the United States. And every now and again, I get a letter from a correspondent who says, as one did recently, the next time the USA decides to end the Canadian nuisance by taking us over, as in 1812, exactly what do we do? Well, the question should rather be, in this anti-colonialist age, exactly what would they do? And I suggest that when you apply the new manner of thinking to that problem, dissociating itself from the old colonial concept that what the big boys say, the little boys must do, you find that the answer is a much greater measure of independence for the little boy and a much greater responsibility to apply his potentialities to that end which all seek to serve, the preservation of peace. I want to move on, however, from the contribution that Canada can make to the preservation of peace to the larger question of the acceptance of peace rather than war as the final instrument of policy. In other words, to turn the concept around to its simpler form, the abolition or outlawry of war. We've already granted that all-out war and the human race cannot coexist on this planet. But have we looked toward the consequences which flow from this axiom? Have we considered what would happen if we really succeed in outlawing war? I suggest that we haven't, and I think that we should now proceed to consider that. And I'm reminded of the lady who wrote into the advice to the Lovelorn column, saying, our daughter is 19 and away at college. She writes that she's going with a young man who teaches judo. Now, we're a good Christian family. Are we right in wanting our daughter to go out with boys of our own faith? And the answer to that, which I always thought was a model of simplicity, went like this. Judo is the art of self-defense without weapons. Better check his spiritual weapons. I suggest that we have reached the point now where our thinking must be directed to the art of self-defense without weapons, and that we had better check the spiritual weapons of our opponent. I'm not advocating immediate disarmament. I am suggesting that we explore its consequences before we take our stand, the consequences of total disarmament. What would divesting ourselves of weapons do to us economically, politically, and spiritually? What would the acceptance of peace as an ideal do to us economically, politically, and spiritually? I'd like you to consider this matter tonight, and I would like you to consider it tomorrow night, the night after, and the next week, and the next month, and the next year. The effect on nations accustomed to spending 60% even of their budget on weapons would be disastrous. There could be no sudden cancellation of orders. There can be no sudden disarmament. It's very doubtful whether Premier Khrushchev himself, with all the potentialities afforded by dictatorship, could, as he demanded, disarm completely in 4 years. The Russians to whom I've talked don't believe that this is possible. But the demand for disarmament, the cry to disarm in 4 years, is a very powerful emotional magnet for the newly born, underdeveloped nations who think wistfully of what could be done with the billions that we put into armaments if they were put instead into roads and schools and soil conservation and power production or irrigation or public health or slum clearance or housing and so on ad infinitum. I've met in your own university here people who've looked at the amount that Canada puts into armaments and thought, my heaven, if we only had this for research, how much further ahead we would be. So this notion that the Russians put forward of complete disarmament within 4 years deserves something very much more than a brush-off, although I don't believe that it is practically possible. But it surely would have been of interest to have inquired how Mr. Khrushchev proposed to deal with the problems which total disarmament would create. One of two things would have happened if we had made this demand and inquiry of Mr. Khrushchev. Either we should have found that the Soviets had not worked out their thoughts on this proposal, in which case it would have been shown up for the emptiness that it was, and its propaganda value would have been destroyed. Or if the Soviets had done serious work in this field, they may have reached some exceedingly important and interesting conclusions. Very interesting examination of the consequences of total disarmament, of the consequences of seriously adopting peace rather than war as a goal, were undertaken by the American historian Walter Millis. He observed that the world had been relying on war to carry out a number of functions, to be sure with increasing inefficiency, and he put some very pertinent questions about the authority or the entity or the new machinery which would be needed to carry out these functions if war were outlawed. Now, what are these functions which we rely on war to fulfill? I'd like to call some of them to your attention. We've been relying on war for a long, long time for very many functions of human society. And when you put it that way, it opens up a new field of thought. What have we been relying on war to do? Well, one thing, we've been relying on war to provide an economic stimulus which will lift the world or our economy, our national economy, onto another quantum level of production. You recall during the 30s, even after about 7 years of the New Deal, and all its vast expenditures, vast for that time at least, were unable to bring the figure of unemployed in the United States down below 5 million. It wasn't until war production orders were placed, first by the United Kingdom and then by Washington, that any impact was made on that hard core of unemployment. And it may be significant today that in this recent recession, or the figures of unemployment for the first time in the United States are roughly at 7% of the working force. It may be significant that in the recovery from the 1958 recession, which was only a partial recovery, although production figures rose, employment figures did not rise comparably. Production rose, but it didn't make the bite on unemployment that it should have made. In other words, are we now relying on war production to cut into this enormous roster of unemployed? Is the world incapable of providing work for its idle in any other way except by going to war? Because this method is no longer appropriate. Some substitute must be found. It may be expensive, but it's not nearly as costly as war or its preparations. Now let's look at a moment at the scientific and technical advances which have been made in the last two generations under the impact and impulsion of war. World War I was the great forcing house of the airplane and of radio broadcasting. Plane-to-plane and plane-to-ground conversations were, I think, first carried out by the RAF in World War I in 1918. Consider the great advances which took place in World War II in missiles, in atomic energy, and in radar. Here again, what substitute do we have in mind for war as a stimulus to research and invention and development? Are the world's democracies proposing to stimulate scientific discovery by some other means? Because if they're not, we're going to stand still. We can't stand still. We have to advance. Consider this matter of the protection of foreign investments, which was carried out prior to World War I, sometimes by the appearance offshore of a gunboat, by the creation of extraterritorial courts or enclaves, or by the organization of customs and similar devices basically made possible by the application of power or the threat or act of war. We've already renounced this function of war or the threat of war, this function of protecting foreign investments. And one consequence of this is that foreign investments are no longer secure. It's one of the reasons why there is so very little foreign investment in the newly developed lands, or for that matter, in some of the older lands which are still underdeveloped, is the fact that investments are no longer reasonably secure. We have renounced war, we have renounced the gunboat as the gilt edging on a bond. Canada, of course, has been a beneficiary of this, because private capital has flowed to Canada in search of advantageous returns, because it has felt sure that It has a reasonable security, reasonable return on investment. The Kennedy administration, which is talking in terms of much larger financial contributions to the defense of the Western, much larger financial contributions to the development of underdeveloped nations, has to find some method by which these investments can be protected without the use of war, because we are no longer able to use war or the threat of war as a means of protecting foreign investments. One of the ways in which this is being done is by channeling the investment of the taxpayer in his government into special funds, which in turn are channeled into the development areas through government channels. This is one effort to find a substitute for the threat of war as a means of protecting foreign investments. There's another very important matter in the past which we have left to war, and that is political and social reform and organization. In the past, we have left war do that. Consider the shattering of the first British Empire under the impact of the American Revolutionary War and of the basic changes in thought which this appeal to arms created. Consider the impact in World War I of war on Tsarist Russia, or the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the German Empire, or for that matter, the British Empire. For it's during the stress of World War I that Canada obtained its full autonomy and its first signature of a treaty of peace with the signature of the Treaty of Versailles, as the result of the impact of war on the political setup of the then British Empire. What plans do we envisage for changing political and social organizations which have outgrown their usefulness without falling back on the threat of war? Can we go along with the Chinese and say that war is inevitable must inevitably be used as the instrument of political change? We can't do that because we know that war can no longer be used as this instrument, since it will end all political organizations. But can we continue progress? Can we continue progress adequate to keeping up with the birth rate without this forcing house of war? In the old days, war, disease, and starvation took care of the birth rate. As one after the other is eliminated, what do we propose as a substitute before there's standing room only on the war? You know, we've no clear answer to these questions, and I would commend them to your thoughtful contemplation, pointing out that we have some major problems before us at the moment. We have the problems of disease, the problems of bridging the gap between surplus food and hunger. We have the problem of the limitation of population and the improvement of education. Will peace, and can we in peace, provide the stimuli which will meet these problems? Or would the world in peace relapse into a rigid pattern of conservation, such as afflicted civilizations in the past? The Chinese still believe that this would be the case. The Chinese communists still believe in the stimulus of war, in social reform. I've pointed out to you how that idea may have arisen. The Chinese are still committed to their theory that war is a legitimate means of bringing in social reform. Mr. Spark, whom I quoted earlier, disposes of this idea pretty roughly. "Nobody can believe that now," he said. "The idea of a military victory, as it has existed and in its role in the history of humanity, must be struck from our vocabulary. A military victory is no longer possible." National governments acting individually are probably incapable of resolving the problems which in the past we've left to the catalysis of war. But what other possibilities exist beyond national governments? And is the world yet ready for the imposition of a supranational government? I suggest that the example of the United Nations is in a way comforting, but the problems now before the United Nations suggest that the world is not yet ready for a global supranational authority. And some alternatives have been attracting attention, the possibility of establishing regional authorities of like-minded peoples whose traditions and habits provide a certain amount of common ground. And this is the direction in which NATO might profitably have advanced if it hadn't been distorted into a strung-out military alliance of incompatibles. The best-known advocate of the possibility of wider unity within the North Atlantic community is Clarence Strite, whose views have evolved from union now between Britain and the United States to the possibility of a union of like-minded people in the North Atlantic community. And I'd like to call to your attention some steps which have been taken in this direction already. Congress has passed a resolution, passed it last year, authorizing American participation in a convention of NATO states to examine how greater political and economic cooperation among their peoples may be promoted. The resolution provided for the appointment by the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President of the Senate of 20 private citizens to as a U.S. Citizens Committee on NATO. This was required to arrange for conferences with similar citizens commissions from other NATO countries to explore means by which greater cooperation and unity of purpose might be developed to the end that democratic freedom would be promoted by economic and political means. The stress on civilian citizen members was so that whatever ideas might crop up could be considered without committing the United States or other nations officially. It was the same device which was adopted in 1787 when the 13 colonies established what finally became the Constitution of the United States. There were citizen committees appointed to look into the matter without committing the individual states, and they came up with this very remarkable constitution. I don't imagine that so great an advance could be made under present circumstances, but it would be exceedingly interesting to have an Atlantic Convention made up of citizen representatives from the various NATO nations to see what possibility there would be of creating some sort of supranational state in this area. This convention, meeting with the best minds in Europe and Canada, without obligating their several governments, might come up with some very novel and exciting ideas. But let me return for a moment to Mr. Sparks' insistence that something be done to give social and economic and political progress and development the impetus which in the past they have received from war. In the same speech to which I referred earlier, Mr. Sparks said, "I am really convinced that if in times to come we should pass on from Cold War to peaceful coexistence, the communist threat would increase, become more dangerous, and more difficult to cope with. In other words, because there is a certain stimulus on the communist side toward social and economic reform, which for the moment we do not possess to that same extent on the democratic side, and which in the past we have, both of us, relied upon war to provide." The fact is that the important gap today is not the missile gap nor the bomber gap. The deadly, vital gap in our armor today is the chasm between science and politics, between the enormous progress made by man's technical ingenuity and the failure to progress along political and social lines. Politically, we're still roughly at the point reached by the Greeks 2,500 years ago. Scientifically, the Greeks at that time were still pondering the ability of amber, when rubbed, to attract scraps of paper. The Greek word for amber was electron. Modern mastery of the electron has enabled the Russians to devise and guide the probe which would make the first report on the physical surroundings of the planet Venus. It, or something very like it, could indeed carry to a neighboring planet or to the moon that other triumph of control over the electron, the hydrogen bomb. In fact, the destructive power of mankind has reached out into the solar system. His constructive power, on the other hand, has not yet encompassed the Atlantic community. That is the measure of the gap between scientific and political thinking that we have to bridge. And I would suggest to you tonight that by far the most significant contribution that Canada can make to peace is the thoughtful determination of how this gap between scientific and political thinking can best be filled. That is the real problem. The most urgent contribution of Canada today would be the philosophical development of a system of ideas based on the data that we already know, based on the necessity of bridging this gap between scientific and political thinking. And the problem, as I pointed out earlier, is not how to defend the country in war, since it is indefensible, whether as a neutral or an ally. The problem is to discover what would be Canada's most telling contribution to the preservation of peace. Would it be as a minor contributor to the deterrent, or as a major and individual contributor to leadership of the neutral world, helping to bring Western social and political ideas to the level which scientific ideas have already reached, and promulgating and fostering those ideas among that neutral group which has hitherto been the most almost exclusive preserve of the Afro-Asian states? That's the problem which I leave with you tonight, thanking you enormously for this privilege of having been able to put it to you. Good night, and thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Minifee has kindly consented to answer a few questions from the floor this evening. And so if you compose your thoughts for a moment, we will have a few questions now.
I haven't a bit of doubt but what there are an enormous number of peace lovers in the People's Republic of China, but those they do not encompass the leadership of that republic. If the word of Mr. Nehru, as a good observing practical man in the way of the steamroller, can be relied upon, Mr. Nehru's version is quite different. The Chinese aggression which he so determined on the frontiers of India would suggest that the role of war has not been renounced by the Chinese leadership. And another reasonable authority, which I don't usually use, is Mao Zedong himself, who recently proclaimed that war was one of the imperatives in enforcing social and political reform, and he based this on Lenin's doctrine, to the severe annoyance, I think, and some discomfiture of Comrade Khrushchev. I think we have it on reasonable authority.
Next question. Sir? Professor Conway.
I think the Canadian influence has been established much more completely by its actions from the Suez Crisis on, by its extremely bold and courageous initiative in the formulation of the United Nations Emergency Force, which has kept the peace in the Near East, this policing action. I am rather strongly of the opinion that the influence of Canada has been exerted in the United Nations from that time on, rather than in its earlier participation in international wars. I think perhaps that Canada's participation in World War I and II, in World War I certainly won for it the privilege of autonomy. In World War II, it brought it another step forward into the world of independent nations, but those methods of social and political change are no longer valid. We can no longer use war as a method of social and political change and experimentation as was done in the past. I think that was very clearly determined from the time of Suez on, and the increasing influence of Canada in the United Nations from that period on has been very noticeable indeed.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
It's a very good question indeed. And I will add that I'm so glad you asked it. This is the habitual resort when you don't know what on earth the answer is going to be. I did point out earlier in my talk, I think, President Kennedy is facing one of these difficulties, and one of his answers to it is the canalization of more and more of the taxpayers' money into funds like the International Development Fund, the Inter-American Development Fund, the World Bank, and other organizations which in fact are the provision by the governments of funds for development, which prior to World War I, for instance, were provided by the private investor in Britain, in France, and so on, who coughed in and bought 7% Nicaraguans, for instance, under the mistaken belief that he gets 7% on his money for some considerable period of time as guaranteed on the small print on the back. However, my friend here in the audience brings in one of these dirty words, socialism. I'll tell you a little story about that. The forerunner of Mr. Mikoyan in the United States, one of these early spires out of the land, Mr. Kozloff, had a very interesting experience when he went across the United States, observing with a very keen and appreciative eye what went on there. And he got out as far as California, as all good Russians do. Russians are as attracted to California as Americans are to Paris. All good Russians probably hope to go there when they die. Anyway, Mr. Kozloff got there before he died, and he was going around this happy paradise being escorted about by the governor of the state of California. The governor of the state of California wanted to impress his visitor, so he took him to see Central Valley, where formidable, magnificent works of water conservation, of irrigation, of hydroelectric production are being carried on. It's an enormous project, and with commendable pride, the governor of California showed it to this unregenerate Russian. And the unregenerate Russian said, who's carrying out this project? And the governor said, the fine state of California is carrying out this project. Ha-ha, said the Russian, socialism, huh? Good God, said the governor of California, no, we don't call it that here. I would say Mr. Kennedy. It's all right. I hope it is. I hope it will be. I hope it does.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, I think Canada has already initiated a good deal of thinking and a good deal of practice in that way. The creation of an international police force is one of the results of Canadian intervention and thinking in the follow-up of the Suez Crisis. There is undoubtedly a very great role for the perceptive and progressive neutral in that way. This whole problem of how in fact you adjudicate disputes, because there will always be disputes, how in fact you create the possibility of change and movement and advance is an enormous problem for which we haven't begun to do our thinking yet. We're still thinking in terms, whether we admit it or not, of war as the catalyst, of war as the solvent. We are not beginning to think yet of peace and the problems that it brings along with it, any more than we're beginning to think of disarmament and the problems that it too would bring along with it. I agree with you that this is one of the great points on which thinking must be done, and thinking aloud, horrid phrase, thinking in public, probably the equally horrid phrase, but it must be done. It must be, you must think and you must talk and you must question. It all must be done, and must be done in a hurry. Well, it's worth thinking about, it's worth talking about. There are a number of weak points to that, that it would take a good deal longer than the time we have currently here to develop, and it's nevertheless, all these ideas are worth considering. I think that in the course of the next few years, we've got to look at all sorts of exuberant and unorthodox ideas, and I hope that I shall see and hear from Dr. Nemitz that you are doing these things out here. I look to the West Coast to raise the ideas as superlative in their size and attraction as your trees.
Yes, sir.
Yes. We will agree, I think, all of us, that this policy of positive neutrality would be advantageous to the world situation. At the same time, for the moment, isn't it true that the peace is being kept by, if you like, a balance of power? Now, if you advocate that Canada takes this position of positive neutrality, are you also arguing, for example, say that Britain and Germany and France and Turkey and Norway, just to take example, pursue the same policy, then perhaps the communist people would feel themselves strong enough, their leaders, to pursue an effective and victorious, or largely victorious war. Then if it's doubtful that we can all pursue this positive neutrality, is Canada the country, in fact, that should do so? Or are we not so strategically, economically, and geographically connected to the United States that we should hold our position as a power monk and perhaps allow an older country with greater spiritual resources to build up this new philosophical idea of the country?
I guess in Saskatchewan we have a little higher estimation of our spiritual resources and of our ability to have a good crop next year.
I'll take the last question now from you, sir. Yes?
I think Mr. Wiley's statement was correct. There are indications that there is an instinctive turning toward a bright light or any unusual noise, light, or object. I think that is very probably true. There were indications in some of the hearings which were not too precise, and a good deal of it was eliminated under the when the hearings were made public. But I believe that that is correct. It's another factor which is one of the most appalling, and which reduces to almost unbelievable absurdity the idea that there is indeed any defense against these things. There is no defense. Wiley himself was quite remarkable in his ability to forecast the effects of atomic fission as applied to weapons. He was extremely active in civil defense. He is an able, a factual, a thoughtful, and a reliable observer. I would think that from what I've heard of testimony and noted indications in the available texts, that that is probably correct. She always does. I'm so glad. My wife certainly keeps my economic house in order. I don't really have an answer to that. I'm very interested in the efforts of women to take a more prominent and active part in political thinking. It's always been a disappointment to me that women, up to now, should have availed themselves so little of the potentiality offered them by the right to vote. Since women had the vote, there has been very, very little observable change in the political attitudes of mankind, man and womankind. I think very probably that if women get sufficiently stirred up to do more thinking, and that they, as they have time now to do more thinking, allegedly at least, my wife still says that she doesn't have any more time now than she ever did, but it is, I think, possible to have a very great improvement in political mores if women do take the fullest possible advantage of the opportunities offered to them by universal suffrage, which they haven't yet undertaken. I'd like to see a very great deal more public speaking instead of private speaking done by women.
Ladies and gentlemen, in this... In this Well, I really, if it's a short question, because Mr. Minifee, I promised him that we would stop at 15 to 10, but let's hear your question now.
Why? Why should we? Of course not. And, of course we don't have to. I see no earthly reason why you should put the USSR and the USA on the same level if you're neutral. No, there's just no logical sequence to the matter.
Well, in this large audience tonight, I see with us the honorary president of the Institute, the president of the university. I wonder if I might impose on you, Dr. McKenzie, to thank our speaker this evening.
To Chairman, to Minifee, ladies and gentlemen, this really was most unfair. I thought I was well concealed in the body of the audience with an overcoat on and practically wearing a hat. And here I am. However, I do count it a very real privilege to have the opportunity of thanking a friend of mine and of many others here on your behalf for one of the most thought-provoking and stimulating addresses that it has been our privilege to listen to in many a year. And an address about a topic that is far and away the most important to every human being in every country in the world today. Now, it doesn't matter much whether Mr. Menifee's arguments or opinions are right and wrong, right or wrong, in the sense of the details of them. And I'm sure, knowing him, that he couldn't care less about your acceptance of his opinions and his views, other than the acceptance of a realization of the seriousness of the possibilities facing us as human beings and the necessity, which he stressed so ably, of finding new and different ways of meeting this situation and solving our problems. And so, ladies and gentlemen, on your behalf, as I say, I count it a great privilege and to extend to Mr. Menifee our very real and sincere thanks for a remarkable address this evening. Thank you.